These days, it seems, if a building is still standing past the age of 30, it almost inevitably has a ghost story attached to it. If a building has been standing for nearly 200 years, it likely holds hundreds of ghost stories. Add to that fact that the building was built on a burial ground that imprisoned those deserving and not through one of the darkest periods in American history. You then have a structure almost glowing with the paranormal. That building is the haunted Old Charleston Jail. But who are the ghosts of the Old Charleston Jail? This is not a haunting with one lone spirit. This is a haunting with literally hundreds of ghosts, some from the days of the jail, other ghosts from a time period dating back to the 1700s prior to its construction. One of the most compelling ghost stories of the Old Charleston Jail involves a woman named Lavinia and her husband. The couple for many years would lure unsuspecting travelers to their hotel, drug them, murder them, and then steal their belongings. After many years of running their scheme, they were tried and hanged. Before their death, Lavinia pledged that she would see the devil herself and ask the locals if they had any messages for the Dark Emperor before she was hanged. It seems she didn't get very deep into the bowels of the underworld, as her spirit still lingers in the halls of the jail to this day. One of the most shocking facts of the Old Charleston Jail is the fact that up until the late 1930s, it was operated and housed both local and federal prisoners without running water, plumbing, or electricity. It was truly a cruel and unusual medieval-style prison operating in the United States at the same time Bing Crosby and Ella Fitzgerald were on the radio. It's no wonder the restless souls still linger there today.
Well, it's a little more difficult for me to portray an initial impression because I have become quite enamored with the building and the location because I've been working there now for well over 2 years. And I grew up here. I'm a native Charlestonian. And so during my childhood, there were moments when my parents would go visit someone downtown and we would turn the corner on Franklin Street or on Magazine, and the building would loom large as you rounded the corner. But I think I can tell you that for the average person visiting Charleston, as you walk down Magazine Street or come at it from Queen, you realize that you're looking at something that is truly an anomaly, that it shouldn't be there, that there's something wrong. Why is this medieval-looking Gothic building with crenellated towers, you know, looming up in the middle of this otherwise fairly modern-looking neighborhood? Now, you know, there is no such thing as truly modern in Charleston because there are always older buildings pickled around and stuck inside more modern structures. But in the area where we are, because of an earthquake that struck Charleston in 1886 and took everything else out, there is this no man's land around the building as well, which adds to the creepiness. You know, it's open, which is unusual because the city is very dense. So, but when you come around, you look at this thing, it looms up three stories. The two towers in the front on Magazine Street actually loom up an additional story. So they're four stories high, so they stand up above the rest of the structure and they look down. It's gray. It's dismal looking. There's no color. The bars on the windows, which were original to the jail as it was built in 1802, are rusted. The doors are also from the original period construction. They've faded over the years, and so the whole building blends into like a mass of gloom. And you look at it and you start to piece it apart. You notice that there are different sections to it. And as you walk around it, and the yard is quite wide, it's no man's land. As you walk around, you just become amazed at how this thing could still be standing here after all those years. Why it wasn't bulldozed long ago in some modern condominium complex built in its place. But this is Charleston. And we have the oldest preservation ordinance in the country. It was adopted in 1930. And so when this building did wind up becoming vacant, still belonging to the city in 1939, the city of Charleston had the wherewithal and the foresight to simply sit on it for 60 years, just let it sit there empty. And that adds to the mystique, because when something sits like that, that long, empty, it seems to attract things. And that's the also the impression you get from the jail, is that it's not just the misery and the suffering and the hangings and the disease, the yellow fever that swept through and killed all those people. It's not just that. There's something else that's added to it, and it's that neglect. And it comes through as you watch and as you walk around it.
Take us back to the very beginning of when this structure was built, why it was built, and what life was like in Charleston at that time.
Well, it all pivots around the date 1802. And up until 1802, Charleston had relied upon the old dungeon underneath the Exchange Building, which still exists, but it's about 10 blocks away, had relied upon that dungeon as a place to incarcerate criminals. Up until that time, in the dungeon, which dates back to 1680, when the settlers first arrived from England, that dungeon never had cages. That was not a concept in English penal systems. It was you relied upon the walls and the floors to shackle people, to hold them, until you were going to do one of two things with them. You were either going to hang them, or you were going to hurt them and then let them go. And that mindset was shifting in 1802. The city was very wealthy. It had gone through a few hard times after the Revolutionary War, which was only about 20 some odd years previous. And the city was ready to become, it was making statements. It was trying to show off its wealth. And one thing it decided it needed to do was it looked to England, it looked to New York, and saw what they were doing with the penal system and began to copy them. But they also wanted to go one step forward and be better than everybody else, because the city had that mindset as well. And so when they built this thing, it was meant to be state of the art. And what that meant to them in 1802 was cages, lots and lots and lots of cages, because they were going to hold people for periods of time now beyond what they had done in the past. In the past, when you brought people in to hang them or hurt them, it was expedited because there wasn't very little room. But now we're going to open it up. We're going to have rooms with cages where we can hold people, and we'll have an opportunity to work with them. And in the United States at that time, and again, this had begun in England, there were reformers in the system, mainly people of strong religious faith, mainly Baptists and Quakers, who were advocating that a penal system should provide a source of reform. It should provide prisoners with an opportunity to see the error of their ways and to make them better people. Now, these Christian reformists were not necessarily going to change the outcome. People were still going to be hurt. They're still going to be hanged, or they're going to be hurt and released. But at least we're going to have a time here to put them behind bars, make them sit and think about what they're doing. And that is why today, when we see a structure like that, one of the words that pops up in the English language is penitentiary, because they wanted these people to be penitent. Now, that's a very cute idea to us. It's very naive, because we know that's not true. We know, because we've become jaded over the centuries, we know that criminals are criminals, that reform has been attempted in the past and is probably not a very necessary, and of course this is very political in and of itself, not necessarily a productive use of resources. What we're really trying to do is protect the public. But back then it was this noble effort to bring people in and offer them a chance to stop their sins, and then perhaps if they were released, it would give them an opportunity to become better citizens. And then if they weren't released, if they were hanged, at least they would go after having made peace with their creator. And that was what motivated all of this. There was a lot of talk about it, and they put their money down. They didn't have a lot, but they authorized the building, and they began construction in the late 1790s. And by 1802, it had been completed at least in its core section. it was all completed. And they began to take prisoners in 1803, and for the first time had the option of throwing them in cages.
So once it was physically there, up, running, and the attempts at reform began, how did that go?
It didn't go well. It didn't go well. Because the folks who were advocating these reforms did not wind up, surprise, surprise, being the people who were actually running the jail. The people running the jail, and this is something that you get as you read through the histories that are available to us, the scholarship and some of the archival records that are still left here in the city, and also from Union memoirs, strangely enough, written by Union soldiers who have been kept prisoners there as POWs in the Civil War. What you realize is that it became something entirely different from its original intent. It became just the opposite of what was intended, because in addition to building the structure in 1802, they also built around it a wall 20 feet high. And that set the tone, because what that did was isolate that structure from the rest of Charleston society, and it became a secret place. It became a gulag. And when people went in there, it became common knowledge that you would be very lucky if you ever came out. And it was because of the lack of facilities. There was, when this thing was shut in 1939, it did not have running water. It had no plumbing. It had no electricity. They had not even bothered to put gas lights in the jail. So this thing sunk into the unconscious of Charleston's political elite. It became a place where something happened, like a black box, and they didn't care what it was. And I have to say, and this is going to come up in the interview, one reason for that is because they were already doing that to the enslaved people. And what happened was, once you launch a program of cruelty, sadism, and brutal repression on a group of people who are enslaved, suddenly what you might or might not do to people of European descent in the old city jail pales in comparison, and the bar is set very low. And that's what happened with the jail.
Obviously, it was in operation for quite some time, all the way up into the 1930s. But within those time windows, many, many inmates came and went through those cell blocks. What were some of the more notable occurrences or events that happened as it was a functioning prison?
Well, the most notable, and the one the person who has captured the attention of Charlestonians, has become a key component of their darker psyche, a person who has risen and taken on a life of her own, where the legend has become greater than the actual historical figure, without doubt, is Lavinia Fisher. Lavinia Fisher was a very young woman in 1818, 25 years old, married to a man named John Fisher. The two of them were a very loving couple. There's no doubt, based on even on the historical record, that they were madly in love with each other, like a Bonnie and Clyde. And these two operated a hotel 6 miles outside of Charleston, and the hotel was aptly named 6 Mile Wayfarers Inn. And this hotel catered to frontiersmen. These were men coming from far away, like West Georgia and Alabama, making their way into Charleston, usually traveling alone with a single wagon loaded with furs and other items they may have traded with Indians on the frontier. And remember, this is in the early 1800s. And they're traveling into Charleston because it's the biggest city at the time, the biggest port, and they're going to go down to the docks on East Bay Street and sell their goods and return home. And this is a long journey. And most of them over time developed a habit of stopping at this particular hotel to break their journey. And then they would get up in the morning and finish the route into Charleston and make it to the docks. Well, John and Lavinia realized that these men were very vulnerable. We don't know why they turned to a life of crime. There are some theories, and one of which actually touches upon slavery. But in any event, these men began to disappear. And by the end of 1818, over 120 of them had disappeared. And at first, no one noticed. by the time loved ones came from far away, they would arrive. Charlestonians would not have remembered them, and the trail would have gone cold, and these people would have returned home puzzled, but without any idea of what had happened to their father, their husband, their brother, their uncle. And as time went on, as more men vanished, attention was drawn to the hotel. All signs pointed toward that as being the focal point of these disappearances that no one could pin it on. Until one day someone did escape and alerted the police. He arrived at the police station in downtown Charleston, battered and beaten, and told the police that this was a place of death, that this hotel was basically a trap, and that when these men would go in, Lavinia would talk them up. "Hello, kind stranger. Where are you from? What you got on your wagon? What do you think your furs are going to fetch down at the docks tomorrow morning? By the way, are you alone?" And if they truly were alone, they would be marked. And Lavinia would go back to the kitchen, come back to the stranger, and sit a cup of hot tea next to him and insist that he drink it. "Kind stranger, drink this tea. It will help you sleep." And it was poison. It was oleander tea. Oleander leaves steeped in regular tea makes a very powerful concoction. And they would drink it, not knowing, and it takes a little while to kick in. So Lavinia would then escort them to a room. "I have a special room for you, stranger. Follow me." And she would, in candlelight, take them down this long, dark hall to a special room she and John had set up as a murder room, very much like H.H. Holmes, although they way preceded H.H. Holmes by decades. And the man would go in the room. He would start to feel ill, lay down on a bed, and presumably never wake up. But John and Lavinia also had a backup system. In the middle of the night, they could pull a lever, and it would cause the bed that the victim was sleeping on to collapse into a pit below. And at that point, John and Lavinia would be poised down below in the pit with knives in their hands. And they were known to have stabbed some of the victims when the poison had failed to do the job. And then John would dispose of the bodies. First, they buried them in the pit. And then later, they buried them in the yard. And this went on. You know, they got away with it because there are no bodies. But when this young man escapes, and it's a fascinating story in and of itself, which I can go back to if you'd like. There's a whole story about how John Peoples, this innocent young man from West Georgia, kind of walked into this trap and somehow managed to escape. But in any event, the police are alerted. A mob also hears of this revelation, and the mob goes up to the hotel and almost lynches the Fishers, but the police intervene and take the Fishers away. The mob burns the inn down, which of course also destroys evidence. And then the Fishers are brought back to the Charleston City Jail, the old district jail. On the second floor, in one of the main cell blocks, is a section, there's a corner, where we believe that Lavinia and John were allowed to remain together, because back then, women were not separated from men as a rule in the jail. They were mixed in with the general cell population. And John was terrified. His wife was beautiful, and he did not want anybody messing with her. So we imagine what he did was just valiantly trying to defend her in this horrible, horrible environment. They languished in the jail for about a year. They had made a great deal of money off these crimes. The whole motivation for it was robbery. And they used the money to postpone their trial. But then, and in that sense, of course, some things never changed. But eventually they faced justice at Charleston County Courthouse, which is still standing. The courtroom where they were tried is still there at the intersection of Broad Street and Meeting Street. They were convicted and sentenced to be hanged. And this was very controversial. The sentence itself was very controversial back then, because by the time this all happens, it's 1820. It's January of 1820. And at that time in South Carolina, there had been a long-standing tradition, and there was even a statute which said that the state of South Carolina did not hang married women. On very few occasions had they ever executed a woman at all. And when they had preferred to burn them at the stake, thinking that that was more humane. They thought, for some strange reason, that hanging a woman was undignified. And so in the past, there had been several occasions where they had burned women at the stake. In fact, one who had been accused of being a witch. But at this point, the judge in the case caved to public uproar and opinion and pressure and said, just ostensibly overlooking the law, sentences both to hang, sentencing a married woman to hang. And the legend says that at the trial, when Lavinia heard this, she was shocked and actually fainted in court. And when she recovered, became very defiant and challenged the judge and said, "Your Honor, you cannot hang me. I am a married woman. I know the law." And the judge looked back at her very casually, looked over his bench and said, "Mrs. Fisher, I have given this some serious thought. All I have to do is make sure that the executioner hangs your husband first, in which case you then become a widow." And, of course, there's a giant uproar in the courtroom, and Lavinia realizes that she's about to die. So they take the two back to the court. They're put back, this time up in the upper section of the jail where death row was. And there's a point where John actually makes an escape, but is later recaptured. And that's a whole separate story, which I'd love to go into. But to follow this storyline at its core, on February 18th, 1820, the jailers pull Lavinia and John out of the death row cage that they had been placed in, put them in a wagon, a caged wagon, a paddy wagon from 1820, take them over to a special gallows that had been built just for them. Some people say it was up at Line Street, others say it was down near the courthouse. But in any event, this is before the internet. This is already a controversial, very highly publicized case. Thousands of people show up to watch, and they're not happy. And they're bloodthirsty. They want to see these two people hang because they had affected trade. They had interfered with the well-being of the city, and they wanted to see these two enemies of the state swing from ropes. So they hang John first, and according to local newspaper accounts, he stood up on the gallows with the noose around his neck and apologized and said to the crowd, "I'm so sorry, please forgive me for my sins," and made peace with God and went quietly. But Lavinia was a different story. Lavinia, and that's what makes her so interesting, is she wanted to be in control of her own destiny, even up till the end. And she had had connections with local ladies in the city and actually had tried to encourage them to rally on her behalf. And they had actually followed up with the governor, trying to pressure him to pardon her because she was a woman. But the governor was more concerned about winning votes, and so he didn't want to go against the wishes of the populace. So he ignores these pleas. Lavinia's still thinking it till the very end that something's going to arrive at the gallows and be handed to the warden that would authorize him to release her, but it never happened. So she is dragged up to the gallows, literally dragged past the body of her dead husband. And they had embraced right before he was hanged. They were still madly in love. And when they drag her up there, some accounts said that they had to wrap a rope around her waist to drag her up. She was that resistant. And when she got to the top, according to the legend, when they put the noose around her neck and people get a good look at her from down below, she's wearing a white wedding dress. And some people say that she did it because she was hoping a man in the crowd would offer to marry her on the spot and save her under the old statute. But that didn't happen. And other people say that she was already resigned to her death, and that what she was doing was, in her mind, she was now becoming the bride of the devil himself. And just before the executioner had a chance to pull the trap door and release her and drop her, she looks at the crowd and very defiantly screams her famous last words. And this is historic fact. She looks at this crowd and screams, "If any of you have a message for the devil, best you give it to me now, and I will pass it to him, for I shall see him shortly." And then rather than wait to be dropped, again, taking her own destiny into her hands, she commits suicide. She jumps off the gallows and swings out over the crowd. Of course, they go crazy. They scream. They laugh. And it takes her a very long time to finally draw her last breath. She does the hip and jibe. She shakes. And all the while, these people below her, mostly men, are laughing at her. And so she hates this. She absolutely hates this. And her spirit is said to haunt the jail. And she is, I would say, over the course of my paranormal investigations and my conduct of tours through the jail, she is the most active. And I joke with some people sometimes and say, that's Lavinia's castle. Lavinia runs the spirits in the jail. They all take orders from Lavinia.
Now, we've touched on the conditions within the jail. What was the final tipping point? What finally made the authorities say, okay, enough is enough. This is where we are in history. We cannot continue to function this building as a jail.
Well, after the Civil War and after Reconstruction, Charleston was left in a very bad way. And as we all know, and this is a sad historical fact, many black men and some black women were essentially re-enslaved under the 13th Amendment and were placed in jails and became an easy workforce for public projects, and were also farmed out for industrial projects, building private buildings and clearing roads and building bridges. And this went on, you know, with Jim Crow laws, went on well into the 1930s and was dictated pretty much who was in there at that time. Now, there were people of European descent in the jail, quite a number of them, but there was this other larger group of people who had basically probably committed fairly minor crimes, if any at all, and who were kept in the jail. This was one of the first jails in the world that required its inmates to wear striped clothes, because there was so much farming out of labor that they needed to keep tabs on them, and the best way was to just mark them with their clothing. And so the conditions in the jail had deteriorated by the 1930s. No works improvements had ever been authorized by city council, but the jail had become, had started to play a role in incarceration, not just for the city and not just for the county of Charleston, but it was also taking in prisoners from the federal government. In fact, when you look at a roster of the inmates, some of them pop up as pirates. And I often get questions, you know, were there pirates in the jail? No. Swarthy pirates from the 1700s would have been kept over at the dungeon and shackled to the walls. Pirates in this jail, in the old district jail, would have been classic pirates that we call now Barbary pirates. They would have been pirates captured on the high seas in the Mediterranean off the north coast of Africa. And they would have been imprisoned in the old city jail. They would have been brought there by the U.S. Navy. So the federal government, and the reason I bring all this up is because it gave the federal government jurisdiction. And at some point, people were filing complaints with the court. And at some eventual point in 1939, a federal judge looked at the evidence and ruled that what was happening in the old Charleston City Jail rose to the level of cruel and unusual punishment under the U.S. Constitution. It could not be tolerated for another day, and ordered it immediately shut. And one of the things cited that really got everyone's attention, and I think what probably prompted the judge to act so quickly, was the treatment of insane inmates in the jail. There was a section of the jail downstairs in the lowest part where the service rooms were that had been turned into holding cells for insane inmates, where they were basically forced to stand up in small cages, unable to move for weeks at a time. And some of them, if they were volatile and very loud, were put into a room called the coffin room, which had nothing to do with the morgue. The coffin room consisted of 12 iron coffins, and the louder insane inmates were placed in these coffins. These were boxes designed for dead people, and they were kept in there for long periods of time. And many of them died in there. And that was one of the main reasons I think the judge ordered it shut.
When the building sat there for literally a 60-year period, uninhabited, I can imagine this was the behemoth, haunted-esque type building that people would walk by and say, oh my gosh, there's ghost stories attached there, legitimate or not. But what were some of those stories? What were some of those legends surrounding this big Gothic structure that just loomed over Charleston for so many years while it was abandoned?
Absolutely. I mean, no. During that 60 years, people who lived in the neighborhood said that when they would walk their pets in the morning, especially on Franklin Street, which is on the western side of the jail, or if they were running in the morning, or if they were just taking a casual walk in the afternoon or early evening, they would look up onto the second floor in one of the windows, and they would see a beautiful woman looking down at them. and it would send a chill up their spine. This was very frequent. And other times, children would break in there because it was an attractive nuisance. Of course, children were attracted to it, and it was easy to get into. And they would go inside, and there were reports of them having encounters with the paranormal. No child ever died in there during that time. And the only time adults went in there were speculators. And I say that in a nice way. People speculating about what they could do with that space. For instance, and this is all based on city council minutes, during that 60-year period, someone once suggested that they turn it into a kindergarten. That idea was shot down. And then at some other later point, someone suggested that they build a community swimming pool in the yard and turn the building into a community center. Well, then someone politely reminded them that long before the jail was built there, and I didn't get into this, I wanted to just start with the jail, but there's a long history of that property before the jail was even built. Someone reminded them politely that that had been a potter's field and that thousands of bodies were buried underneath there, and that it was probably best that we not disturb them. So that idea was shut down. And then eventually in the 1970s, someone did attempt to turn it into a museum with mannequins and displays. It failed as an enterprise, but I've not heard of any reports of hauntings, but I wouldn't be surprised if one of the reasons it didn't succeed was because the people there were, in a sense, attacked by the ghosts. Because a similar thing happened in the year 2000. A local architectural and engineering school bought the building. Finally, someone was going to do something positive with it. And in 2000, this school, it's called the American College of the Building Arts, an architectural and design school that specializes in training people in restorative arts, things that most people don't know how to do today. Plaster work, brick bonding, carpentry, blacksmithing, all tailored to the renovation and restoration of old historic buildings in the city of Charleston. So clearly a wonderful talent pool to be able to tap into. These folks took over the building and in the first 2 years spent most of their time cleaning it up. And there's some wonderful stories. When they first moved into the building, remember, no electricity, nothing. They moved in and took student volunteers in the summer of 2000 and allowed them to camp in the yard. It must have been a magical time. And these students, so that they could work through the evenings, laid trails of candles through the building and continued to work at night. And they said from the very beginning, there were apparitions, haunting sounds, slamming doors, screams, as these spirits expressed their unhappiness over being bothered after a 60-year hiatus. But the most intriguing report during that time came from a man who was there to supervise, not one of the students. And one night he went into the building thinking there were some other students in there, was going to collect them and get them out. What he didn't realize was that everyone had already left the building, but some of the candles were still lit. And he wanders in, and as he makes his way up to the second floor, he encounters what had to have been the ghost of Lavinia Fisher. She appears in the hallway, looking down at him, and she's done that since then as well. She was poised and simply stared at him with an angry stare, and it freaked him out. Of course, he ran out and quit. And that's usually what happens with people when they encounter the supernatural at the jail. They tend to make a very clear distinction between being there and not being there. And we have the same problem with guides. Some guides who, given the tours, things will happen to them and it will force them to just quit. They can't take it. They don't want to have it happen again, and it terrifies them. So this man, of course, would never go back in the building. Also, one thing that happened during that 60-year period, and there's a guy who works at the jail named Sean Pike, who's been there longer than anyone else. He's a wonderful young man. He was a policeman during that 60-year period, obviously toward the later end, probably in the 1980s. And, of course, it's sitting there empty, and he's on a horseback beat. He's a mounted policeman, and his round included the jail. And he would, because it's an open yard, you know, they would police it. Anyway, he said that on many occasions, and this is why he's attracted to the building, it's why he's so in love with it and so enamored with it. He said that on many occasions he would see that same woman looking from the same window, And on a few occasions, he was convinced that a spirit had messed with his horse, because his horse would get rattled. And he was convinced that it may not have been her, but it was some spirit that wanted him to stay away from there and would agitate his horse and cause the horse to rear up. Also, horse carriage drivers, even today, will tell you that there is a spirit. Some of them say it's Lavinia, because children report seeing a woman come up to the carriage, a beautiful woman wearing a white dress, come up to the carriage and deliberately, on purpose, agitate the horse and cause the horse to rear up. And so some of the carriage drivers are very wary when they drive their carriages by the jail, because they're always anticipating some problem with the horse. So it's deep.
What exactly is the structure used for today? How is it being operated?
It is empty. There is nothing in there. When the American College of the Building Arts moved in 2000, kind of got really going about 2002, they turned it into an active campus. The front section of the jail is a very unique place. It's the part that's nestled between the two towers in the front. It's an apartment, and it was originally designed as the residence of the warden who would live there. And so there have been many wardens over the years who lived in the apartment. That was used by the American College of the Building Arts as offices for the president and staff. The main section of the jail, which was the old section that was packed with crude iron cages, was then empty because the city had pulled those cages out when the jail was shut and had frantically moved them up to a makeshift jail to replace the one they were forced to close. So they used those open rooms as project rooms. And then in the back, which we call the Octagon, an eight-sided building at the very back of the jail, those are smaller rooms, and those were used as classrooms. So the American College of the Building Arts outgrew the space in 2016 and moved out. And it, since then, it has again become an empty building. But we actively give tours there, both during the day and at night, and we conduct paranormal investigations there on average about 3 to 4 nights a week. And so it's busy, but it's just us.
Talk to us about some of the evidence, some of the pieces of information, experiences that you've had or other investigators have had going through the old Charleston jail.
Well, at first I'll keep it personal, and then if you want, I can share with you experiences that that others have shared with me. But there is a spirit on the first floor that has gotten my attention. When we've asked who it is, and this is what we do. We walk through with K2 meters. We have spirit boxes, and we try to engage the spirits. Sometimes we'll use the K2 meters for yes-no questions. And every now and then we'll get answers to questions on the spirit boxes. And there is a spirit on the first floor in a very dark hallway. When we've asked him who he is, the meters will light up. We'll go, "Who's here?" And the answer is always the same. "Animal." "What's your name?" "Animal." "No, what's your real name?" "Animal." And so we've just given him that name, but I just want to make it clear, we're not being condescending. That's what he calls himself. And he crawls on the floor. He likes to get on his hands and knees. He sometimes crawls backwards. He's very agile. He moves fast. And many people have seen him or his shadow moving through that dark hallway on the first floor of the jail. And he has a habit sometimes of rushing up, grabbing that person by the ankle, and growling. We think he's doing it for fun. And we also think that he's insane. We think that he was in one of the insane inmates. And we think he died inside one of those horrible cages down on the first floor where he would have been restrained. And just the other day, I had a brief conversation with him. And I said, "I'd really like to know when you die." And this is very difficult. That's a touchy thing to ask a spirit, because sometimes they don't know they're dead. And so I didn't get an answer. And so instead I asked, "When will you hurt?" Because I figured that might be a little more palatable. And he goes, "86. And what I've learned doing the paranormal investigations is usually if you get a number, you need to put an 18 in front of it. So to me, he was telling me 1886. And that was, of course, the year of the great earthquake. And so in all likelihood, he was killed, trapped in a cage in the bottom floor when some of the ceiling would have collapsed on him. And he is very troubled. I actually feel great compassion for him because I'm sure he died a horrible death. And who knows why he was thrown in there. But you never get the feeling that he's hostile or demonic. He's just playful and a bit mischievous. And it's disturbing because he's a spirit. And you don't know what his intentions are. But over the years, over the 2 years I've been, I've learned to trust him. And he pops up. You know it's him. Sometimes he'll growl. But we have wanted to lure him out. I've been very attracted to him. So is my fiance Joy, who does most of the paranormal investigations there. We've tried to lure him out. And so we discovered, not by accident, but we're shocked at the result. We've discovered that when we bring people in who have beautiful voices and who are willing to sing, that music seems to trigger them. They love music. And that's a whole other set of stories I could tell you. But in this particular instance, when it comes to animal, Joy and I found a dear friend who has a beautiful angelic voice. And we asked him if he would come in one night with us and sing a gospel song and see if animal responded. And so we did a little research and found that a very popular gospel song in 1886 is a beautiful song titled, "It Is Well With My Soul." And our young friend came in and sang that song in the very same solitary confinement room where we believe that animal died. And as soon as he starts to sing, our K2 meters light up deep in the red and stay there, which is unusual. And also, we all felt him. We felt something come in the room, very strong. And the hair on my back went up, and the hair on my arms stood up. And so our friend is singing, and we're listening. We know that animal is there. Mm-hmm. And after he finished singing, on my spirit box, you hear this voice, a very weird voice, go, "Beautiful." And we all look at each other, shocked. And this thrill went up my spine. I mean, it was positive. It wasn't negative. It was very positive. And we start talking about how horrible it would have been to be one of the people stuck in that terrible room, you know, probably with other insane inmates all screaming at the top of their lungs, spitting, you know, throwing things. Just total chaos and mayhem. And on my spirit box, the same voice suddenly says, "Psychotic." That was one of the moments when I knew I had made contact with the spirit world.
That's going to wrap up part one of our interview about the old Charleston jail. In part two, exclusively for Gravekeeper members through our website at thegravetalks.com or patreon.com/thegravetalks, we'll talk more about Lavinia and her interactions with the living, about Potter's Field before the prison was built, and the bodies that lie beneath the prison. Also, John's escape and capture story. What exactly happened? And how did his demise ultimately come about on the grounds of the old Charleston jail? That and more. Keep our show on the air, supported, and get that extra content and advanced episodes of the show before anybody else can hear them. You simply go to thegravetalks.com, click on the support our show, become a Gravekeeper button, or directly through patreon.com/thegravetalks. It's only $5 a month to get access to these exclusive extra features, and we greatly appreciate your support. Without it, we could not continue to do this program and keep it on the air. So please consider supporting it if you enjoy our program on a regular basis. A special thank you to Randy Johnson for joining us on the program today to talk about the old Charleston jail and the experiences that he's had there. For more information on the old Charleston jail, maybe even taking your own tour of it, you can visit their website, bulldogtours.com. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thank you for listening.